Gallery Podcast.
Hello, I'm Miranda Hinckley and this is the National Gallery Podcast. Coming up in this month's episode...
Nobody needed to say, excuse me dear, but could you think about... There just wasn't time. You were expected to arrive with that knowledge inbred. And the way we did it was by coming in and trailing around in our school uniform and looking at paintings. It's a wonderful idea.
Ballet lessons with Rubens, what dancers can learn from fine art. And...
I think this is the gayest painting in the gallery. I mean, there are lots of other gayish paintings, paintings by gay artists and other gay subjects, but for me, it's this one. It's got ladies in big frocks, it's got men in armour, not armour that you want to fight in, sort of dress armour, dressing up. They've been in the dressing up box.
A Leonardo, a Titian? Find out which painting gets Keith Caver's vote. We start, though, with the gallery's big summer exhibition. The first show of its kind in the UK, Radical Light brings together paintings by a group of late 19th century Italian artists known as Divisionists. In last month's episode, curator Chris Riopel described the radical political aims that inspired many of the luminous works in the show. This month, Leah Caribbean explores the Divisionists' extraordinary use of colour, with a little help from artist Gaynor Pelham and her paints.
Well, this is a podcast first. We're in the National Gallery with paints, which is very exciting. I'm here in the education department with the artist Gaynor Pelham, who's going to demonstrate, show me and talk about how the Italian Divisionists got some of their extraordinarily luminous light effects. Now, to start with the basics, Gaynor, could you tell me what it means to paint in a Divisionist way?
What they're actually doing is, instead of mixing any of their colours on their palettes, they're actually putting down on the canvases paints in their primary form. So they're not actually mixing the colours, they're putting the colours side by side on the canvas.
Now, these colours aren't just any old colours.
No, they're actually what we would call complementary colours. And if you think of the three primary colours as red, yellow and blue, if you mix red and yellow, you get orange. And if you had that on a wheel, you would have that actually opposite the blue. So orange is opposite blue. And what it has found is if you put these colours side by side, it will heighten the saturation of each colour.
Now, in the exhibition, in the Radical Light exhibition, there's a painting by an artist called Longoni called Reflections of a Hungry Man, which shows a young man looking at some wealthy diners in a restaurant. And the glass that separates him from these wealthy people is painted in little dots, and it's little dots of pure colour. Now, this to me looks rather familiar in terms of a technique that one might know from, say, the French painters, Seurat and Signac, the pointillists.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the Italians weren't pointillists, really, were they?
No, and that is what is so fascinating about this exhibition. And where we're used to the ideas of pointillism with these sort of dabs, little dots of colour, with the Divisionists, they're using much longer strokes.
Now, this is the bit that I've been looking forward to. I wanted to get some paint. So could you start showing me what it is that they do? How do they get these extraordinary effects?
Well, what they're actually doing is heightening the saturation of colour. Also, what the Divisionists are going to do is work up layer upon layer upon layer. And that, again, is very different from what the pointillists are doing with just dots next to each other. And I'm going to just sort of show you sort of a little bit. And I don't know whether I can mention that these are acrylic colours. Unfortunately, they're not oil paint, just for the amounts of time that we have. If I use sort of ultramarine, and unfortunately, when I'm going to be building up now, because I'm putting wet paint on top of other wet paint, it's going to smudge. And this is where you really need to see the actual paintings for themselves, because when you look at them, you can just see the kind of one layer and then the layer beneath it and the layer beneath it. And it's this kind of tapestry, this sort of woven feeling that I've never really seen anywhere else. It really is absolutely amazing. So you feel that you've got, in sometimes a, what's called an impasto layer, which is very, very thick, sort of crusty paint, where it's almost in relief.
Now, we're battling here slightly against the a troop of children who have arrived in the next room to eat their sandwiches, which is admirable, but noisy. And looking at this painting that you're working up, there's a picture in the exhibition by Segantini called Spring in the Alps.
Absolutely.
Which has this sky that is so blue and intense and bright. It's that extraordinarily bright alpine light.
Yes.
And yet when you look closely at it, it's blue, but it's got red in it. And
yes.
I was just looking at the paint you've got there, this idea of putting colours that you would never think to find next to other ones.
No, and they've got to be very careful about the colours they put next to each other, because if you're not careful, you create a sort of grey look. So how the Divisionists created this sort of amazing luminous feel is sort of extraordinary. So they're actually putting brighter colours next to each other than the pointillist painters that we're used to.
If there are painters out there and they're thinking, right, now I want to have a go at this, what would you say to them? Where should they start? What should they do?
Come and have a look. That's what they need to do. And I think this is what's extraordinary. And I was shocked by seeing these paintings in the flesh, because they're not paintings that we're familiar with. We won't, in this country, have seen these really before. We might know the futurist artists. We might know Boccioni. We might know Balla and Cara. But we're not going to know Segantini. We're not going to know Morbelli. And you have to see those to understand where the later artists come from. And when you see this incredible sort of paint before your eyes, and you could take any part of that Springtime in the Alps, any little section of that painting, and use it as the basis for your painting. I mean, any little section is extraordinary. It's incredibly inspiring. And I think that's what makes this exhibition so exciting.
Gaynor Pelham talking to Leah Caribbean. To do these colourful works justice, you really need to see them close up. So if you're in London during July, come along to the gallery. The Radical Light exhibition will be open throughout the month, and you can buy tickets in person or online with a booking fee. And if you heard last month's feature about the show, you might like to know that curator Chris Riopel features on the exhibition audio guide. You can download an excerpt from the tour as a bonus track with this podcast. If asked for a link between ballet and fine art, you might, after a little head-scratching, come up with the name Degas. Much loved by art buffs and little girls alike, the Frenchman's painting of ballet dancers is a gallery highlight, recognised around the world. What's less well known is that this famous picture is part of a long history of mutual inspiration between the arts. In the 18th century, choreographers were encouraged to study paintings to help them compose attractive scenes on stage, while in the 20th century, both Matisse and Picasso were involved in set design for Diaghilev's famous Ballet Russe. Closer to home, young dancers at the Royal Ballet School in the 1950s were brought to the National Gallery to learn from the old masters. We asked Jennifer Till, a former pupil, to explain why.
My name is Jennifer Till, and I was very lucky to go to the Royal Ballet School in its very early formative days, when we had a director called Arnold Haskell, who had a very clear idea of what ballet consisted of, and it was four elements. Only one of them was dance. The second one was music, and we covered that by going to concerts and music appreciation. The third and fourth were drama and decor, costume, lighting, ambiance, everything else. The last two elements of our training we were meant to pick up from galleries, so it wasn't insignificant. We were meant to pick up all the sort of the feeling of characterization in a non-verbal way from what we saw in galleries. This is a portrait by Anthony van Dyck of Lord John Stuart and his brother Lord Bernard Stuart, and the young men are so flamboyant. They are really exquisitely dressed. The young man with the silver cloak is wearing a sword, and his very fancy boots have got spurs on them. His curls are very feminine, but the face is absolutely not. And the way he's standing, the one leg up, the way he's looking at the viewer, there's no tip of the head, there's nothing diffident. It's very proud, it's very assured. And though the clothes are extremely dramatic, that huge sweep of silver lining in the blue velvet cloak, nonetheless, he is wearing that costume. It's not wearing him. He's not cowed by it. So in terms of characterization, if you got
a boy who suddenly appears, and there he is at Covent Garden, and he's playing a prince. To have an image like that in his mind would kind of feed his body the right stance, the right feeling. This is a portrait by Peter Paul Rubens of a lady called Susanna London, and it's called the Chapeau de Paille, which is her really beautiful straw hat. And the reason I was particularly kind of captivated by this is that very often a dancer, because of the distance from the viewer, covers characterization in a very broad sweep, whereas there are roles that need more subtlety. And this painting is such a subtle representation of a girl, a very pretty girl, who's not really comfortable with where she is. She's wearing a beautiful hat, that's lovely, but her eyes, rather than looking directly, she's looking and her eyes are sliding to one side, almost as though there's somebody nearby, maybe encouraging her, or she's just shy of this situation. Her hands are crossed. It's a closed gesture. And the one thing that she is sort of showing is her betrothal ring. And in that she has a little confidence. Now that sort of movement, that sort of style, that slight tilt of the head, is the sort of thing that in dance you would use for somebody like the betrayed girl in The Rake's Progress, somebody who is suddenly elevated with the rake to a stratum of society that she doesn't understand and isn't comfortable with. Those sort of elements were expected to just be absorbed into you, so that when that was your role, that's what you did. Nobody needed to say, excuse me, dear, but could you think about, there just wasn't time. You were expected to arrive with that knowledge inbred, and the way we did it was by coming in and trailing around in our school uniform and looking at paintings. It's a wonderful idea.
That was Jennifer Till talking about two highlights of the gallery's permanent collection, Lord John Stuart and His Brother by Van Dyck and Le Chapeau de Paille by Rubens. On the 24th of July, a free exhibition opens at the gallery devoted to the subject of love. Paintings by artists such as Raphael, Chagall and Vermeer will be on display, as well as David Hockney's portrait of a same-sex couple, We Two Boys Together Clinging. In preparation for the arrival of this famous painting, we thought we'd find out whether his two boys would be lonely in the National Gallery, or whether there are other same-sex couples in the permanent collection to keep them company. Louise Govier and Keith Cavers offered their suggestions.
This is The Family of Darius Before Alexander, by Veronese, around about 1570. And I think this is the gayest painting in the gallery. I mean, there are lots of other gayish paintings, paintings by gay artists and other gay subjects, but for me, it's this one. It's got ladies in big frocks, it's got men in armour, not armour that you'd want to fight in, sort of dress armour, dressing up. They've been in the dressing up box. And it shows a moment where the Queen Mother, Sisygambis, who's the one kneeling down with Erminon, has brought her daughter-in-law and her grandchildren to Alexander because her son has been defeated in battle. They think he's dead. He's not dead. He's just been defeated. And she comes in and throws herself in front of Alexander for their lives because they think they're going to be raped and pillaged and murdered. And unfortunately for her, she looks around the room and finds this very handsome, battle-hardened soldier, throws herself down in front of him. It's the wrong one. It's not Alexander, it's Hephaestion, Alexander's friend. And she's terribly upset and thinks, well, I've blown my chance at getting away with this. But Alexander steps in and says, no, no, mother, that's all right. He's Alexander too. Because he considers Hephaestion as being almost himself. They're very close. They're lovers. They've been brought up as children together. And for people in history, people who knew classical history, everybody knew that. So as a gay subject, it sort of sneaks in because people knew about Alexander. He did have a wife, actually had two wives, and he did have children, but then so did Oscar Wilde. And he certainly preferred, I think, the company of men.
Keith, what is it about this painting visually that sort of gives the game away to you? Because you look at it and it's kind of very lush painting, but it looks like many other history paintings in the gallery.
Well, for a classical subject, for a Greek subject, it doesn't look very Greek at all. I mean, it looks more like a Handel opera. And the sort of operatic setting, you've got the main characters in the front, lots of crowds behind, sort of chorus up on the balcony. It doesn't immediately sort of give that away. And in fact, the viewer is in the same position as the poor Queen Mother, because it's very difficult to work out which one is Alexander. You know, is it the man in red? The label says it's the man in red. Or is it the one in the shiny armour? But he's sort of pointing to the one in the shiny armour. So it's almost as if he's saying, no. Is he saying, no, this is Alexander too? Or is that Hephaestion saying, no, this is Alexander? So even in the picture, you've got this confusion as to who the two people are. And in fact, it's probably used the same model. They look very, very close.
Now, I also have with me Louise Gauvier from National Gallery Education. Louise, we're going to uncover another sort of subtext in a painting. Which picture are you going to take us to see?
Well, I'm going to look at some girls. Having seen some gorgeous boys, and they really are beautiful, and I think they're aware of it in this painting, they're kind of standing there with their fabulously coloured robes wrapped around them. We're going to now go and look at some naked ladies, but I think with perhaps a slightly different take on who their nakedness might be for. This is a little painting, an intimate painting, meant to draw you in, by François Boucher, done in 1759, and it shows Pan and Syrinx. And Syrinx is this beautiful girl who is being chased by Pan, who, as we know, is a naughty woodland god who is very lusty and has absolutely got her in his sights. As she's running away from him, she reaches a river and persuades her sisters, the river nymphs, to change her into some reeds. And what we actually see in the painting is sort of both moments shown at the same time. We've got Syrinx running away into the arms of one of the women that's saving her, and at the same time then Pan is grasping for her but only getting an armful of reeds, so she's safe from him. Now, what's interesting about this painting, I think, is that if you want to, you can see it in a number of different ways in terms of its eroticism. Traditionally, it's assumed that Boucher is painting for male viewers and that these luscious female bodies are on show for male viewers to enjoy. But increasingly, we find that there are female viewers, sometimes lesbian viewers, who in particular have looked at paintings like this and written about them in quite different terms and see these instead as women who are sharing each other's bodies, who are actually, of course, in this case, the girl is keeping her body for another woman. She's actually turning away from the man. And you can look at Boucher's paintings in some senses as almost utopian spaces where all these nudes just talk to each other, touch each other, and actually the men are really kind of irrelevant. So it's one of those pictures that can be read in a completely different way if that's your own viewpoint.
Louise, how many of these hidden stories do you think there are in the gallery?
Oh, I think there are hundreds, because, of course, for every painting, you're going to have a whole range of meanings that painting might produce for different people. If you ask 10 different people what they think of the same painting, you're probably going to get 10 different stories. And, of course, sexuality is something that's going to feed into that. So different people with different experiences are going to read different things from the same painting. So I think there are probably loads of different pictures in the gallery where this could be the case.
Thanks to Keith Cavers and Louise Gauvier. Their chosen paintings are both on display at the National Gallery, along with all the other pictures mentioned in this episode. Pop in if you'd like to see them for yourself. The gallery's open from 10 till 6 daily and until 9 p.m. on Wednesday evenings, and entrance to the permanent collection is free. That's it for this episode. Until next month, goodbye.